Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a free ebook for you to download today that you won't want to miss. It's called In Conversation with Jordan Peterson, Atheism, Christianity, and the Psychology of Belief. This special ebook was created from an unbelievable podcast with famed Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson. And in it, you'll discover how to bring order to a chaotic world using the wisdom of the Bible. So download your free copy of In Conversation with Jordan Peterson by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. This is a limited time offer, so make sure to do it today. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Hello and welcome along to Unbelievable. It's the program that brings Christians and non-Christians together every week for dialogue and debate, hosted by myself, Justin Brierley. This is the show that aims to get you thinking as part of Faith Explored every Saturday on Premier Christian Radio. You can download past programs, you can find the podcast, features, videos and much more at the website premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Going to be introducing today's guests for a really exciting edition of the programme, asking whether there is an intrinsic value to human life. Peter Singer is going to be one of our atheist guests on the programme today, high-profile atheist, ethicist, philosopher. So we'll be introducing them in a moment's time. But if you haven't heard already and you'd like to get involved, Unbelievable the Conference is coming less than 2 months away now, Saturday the 2nd of July in central London. We've got a brilliant day of training coming up with some really fantastic speakers in the world of apologetics, philosophy, theology and much more besides. J. John, evangelist, will be there. People like Gary Habermas, Tanya Walker, who's an apologist with RZIM here in the UK. And we'll be hearing from her later on in today's programme. So stick around to the end of today's show to hear what she has to say about some of the seminars that she's going to be leading at this year's conference. If you want to get along yourself, find out about the deals on tickets we're doing, you can get a free copy of the last conference on DVD if you buy two or more tickets. Go to premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable2016. Also looking forward to reading some of your feedback to the last few weeks of shows as well towards the end of today's programme. Right now, time to get into today's debate.
You're unbelievable.
Well, today on Unbelievable, we're asking, is human life intrinsically valuable? And the idea that human life is intrinsically valuable is dying, side by side with our Christian culture, says Richard Weikart in his new book, The Death of Humanity and the Case for Life. He claims that ideas that were once used to justify genocide, forced famine and compulsory sterilization are now back in vogue. He covers things like abortion, infanticide, euthanasia, the treatment of those with disabilities and the elderly in his wide-ranging book. Richard is Professor of Modern European History at California State University, joins me as our Christian guest on today's show. Two atheist guests joining me on the show today. Firstly, Peter Singer. He's a bioethicist at Princeton University, well known as an Australian moral philosopher and for his writings in the area of animal and human rights. In fact, he's been voted one of Australia's 10 most influential public intellectuals in the past. Now, he has argued that a human's right to life depends upon their capacity to hold preferences. And that's very much tied to their capacity to feel pain and pleasure. Consequently, certainly he's an advocate for abortion, even possibly questions over whether newborns lack the essential characteristics of personhood. I'm sure we'll get into that kind of thing today. Personism is one of the things he's known for as far as his view of how we should treat humans. And in the second half of the show today, we're going to be joined by another atheist philosopher, a psychologist, Susan Blackmore, for her take on the conversation we'll have had at that point between Richard and Peter, my guests on today's programme. So Richard and Peter, welcome along to the programme. You're both joining me by the wonders of Skype, so we'll see how well our signal holds out. But first of all, Richard, welcome along to the programme. Been a while since we've had you on Unbelievable. What's this latest book all about then, and where has it come from?
Yeah, this book, The Death of Humanity and the Case for Life, is looking at the way that a variety of secular ideologies, and I cover a very wide variety of secular ideologies since the Enlightenment period, have contributed to eroding the Judeo-Christian sanctity of life ethic, thus bringing us into a culture where we have easy acceptance of abortion, even infanticide and euthanasia increasingly as things are going on. So it's looking at the way that a whole host of ideologies that have denied the denied the creator, denied that humans are equal because of their being created equally, and looks at then how they have brought us to this point of what some people refer to as the culture of death.
Your previous books have obviously been in the realm of the ideology of Nazism and Hitler and so on. Do you think we're somehow approaching again a similar kind of mindset that led to the kind of issues that came out of that particular era?
Well, I do actually include discussions of biological determinism, in which I talk about Nazism in my book. I do give a pretty broad historical survey. I also cover communism and environmental determinism and again, a lot of other secular ideologies as well. But what I find particularly troubling about those ideologies is that they do deny human equality. And because they deny human equality, they set up certain categories of people, which they then define as not being, not having human rights, and thus can be disposable. In the case of Nazism, that would be certain racial groups. In the case of communism, that would be certain economic groups. In the case of today's bioethicists, things get defined very differently. And of course, Peter Singer is one of the people, in fact, that I discuss in my book, of course. And things get defined based on mental abilities or rational abilities or preferences.
Where do you particularly disagree with Peter then, most fundamentally?
Well, in my book, one thing that I try to do is look at the most fundamental issues that are relating to this question of, you know, what is it that would give human life value, and how many secular ideologies have tried to undermine the meaning and value of human life. And one thing I would say start off with is that there are certainly a number of areas that I would agree with Peter Singer on, and I think maybe it'd be good to point out some of these things from the start. That is, I agree with him when he says that we should be looking out at the interests of others, not just our own self-interest. I think that's fundamental. I think it's a Christian idea. Paul said, look not out for your own interest, but also for the interests of others. That's out of Philippians chapter 2. So that's a fundamental Christian idea, and I can certainly agree with Peter Singer on that particular perspective. I also agree with him when he talks about the fact that we find fulfillment in pursuing the ethical life and searching for what he calls particular meaning that he thinks that even atheists can have in a human life. But where I fundamentally disagree is I think those particular insights I think only really makes sense in a theistic framework. That is, when he makes a leap from we don't have any meaning in the universe, there's no meaning in the cosmos, he would say, no purpose, no goals, and such. But he thinks for the atheist we can have what he calls particular meaning for individual lives. And I don't see how that leap can get made without that meaning in the second case being simply illusory.
Okay, well, we have the man himself to defend himself. So it's great to have you joining us for the first time on Unbelievable today, Peter. Peter, you've been doing this stuff for decades and well known for some of your writings. I'm sure that some of your positions do get, if you like, exaggerated or you know, secondhand kind of views of them. So it'll be good for you to be able to speak for yourself on this occasion as to where you do draw the line on some of these ethical issues. Do you want to sort of just give us an idea of where you what you do see, your overall take on this question of whether human life is intrinsically valuable? Because I know that you don't necessarily view it as a case of humans per se, but what makes a person. Do you want to talk to us about that?
Well, exactly. But let me just say, it's not only about what makes a person. When Professor Weikart was talking about those who take hierarchical views of value and regard some races as superior to others, I think we also need to look at the way in which we regard our species as superior to others. I accept, of course, that it is superior in terms of intelligence, as far as we know, to any other species existing, though there may be others somewhere in the universe, who knows. But even in terms of having interests, in terms of the capacity to feel pain or to suffer, we're clearly not the only species that can do that. And it's religions like Christianity, I think, that have actually emphasized that difference and therefore led to a great deal of unnecessary cruelty through the ages being inflicted on non-human animals because they raise the human species above others. And there's a long history in Christian theology of people saying that animals don't count, or God gave us dominion over the animals, so it doesn't matter what we do to them. So I want to start by broadening the picture, not narrowing it, so that we recognize that pain is a bad thing, that enjoying life, being happy, is a good thing, and that pleasure and pain are not limited to our own species. So one sense in which I think human life is not specifically sacred is that I don't think that merely the fact that you're a member of the species Homo sapiens gives you in itself a greater significance or even a greater claim to life than a being who is a member of some other species. So that's not to say that I don't think that there are differences between typical humans and non-human animals. Obviously, we are the only species that can have this kind of abstract conversation. And there are other differences as well that may give us a reason for thinking that sometimes the killing of a being like us is more serious than the killing of a being who lacks those characteristics. But I don't want to say that it's just a matter of what species you are that makes the crucial difference here.
Right. When it comes to humans, I mean, I know that, for instance, you're not particularly maybe keen on the phrase humanism as a sort of philosophy of where you stand. You've talked about personism. What if you like, contribute...
No, actually, I don't usually talk about personism. That's not a term that I've used, as far as I'm aware. But you're right that I think humanism as a term for a secular viewpoint is wrong, because I think that we need an ethic that goes beyond just human beings.
Sure. What would, for you, kind of be the kind of things that do accrue a human in particular more value, say, than, you know, a highly developed primate, for instance?
Well, it would be the things that are distinctive of human beings that we can recognize as being morally significant. So, for instance, we can think about our lives over time. We can make plans for the future, not just for the short-term future, not just for how can I get that food over there, or how can I mate with that attractive member of the opposite sex over there, but what will I do next summer? What will I do after I graduate? What kind of a partner am I looking for throughout my life? We can think about those things, and I think you could argue that part of the tragedy of somebody being killed at an early age, when they could have lived for decades further, is that their plans are being thwarted or frustrated. And the work that they've done towards carrying out those plans in the past, maybe studying so that they could graduate and then perform a certain kind of work, that is then in vain.
Yes.
And I don't think that we can say that about any other, any non-human animals, at least on this planet, although I do think we sometimes underestimate the mental capacities of non-human animals.
Sure.
I wouldn't go so far as to say that they can make plans for what they'll do next summer or in 5 years now, yeah, or anything of that sort. So I think that makes a difference, the seriousness of killing.
And to the extent that, say, a human, maybe at a very early developmental stage or even a newborn baby, would not have those kind of mental capacities, the ability to think about, obviously, what they're going to be doing in the future and so on, you do therefore distinguish in terms of the value, the seriousness, let's say, of taking the life of one or the other.
Yes, I think there is a difference. I don't want to put it more strongly than that, but I do think that there's a difference when you develop capacities to think about your life as a whole. Of course, you know, even with newborn infants, the love and care of the parents and of other family members and other, you know, people around is tremendously important as part of what makes it a tragedy when a newborn infant dies. So it's not that there aren't other factors that are very important, but I do think there's something additional that comes, yeah, that develops once you get the kind of capacities that I've been talking about.
Sure. Do you want to go ahead, Richard, and start to lead off this conversation?
Yeah, it seems like one of the things that Professor Singer is claiming is that there's these certain capacities. I mean, he is claiming this in his writings and also here, that is these certain capacities, and he identifies one particular kind of capacity, the planning and self-awareness, rationality. It gets, sometimes those words get used in his writings about it. But in claiming that his opponents, such as myself, are being arbitrary by using the human species as the dividing line, it seems to me there's also a certain arbitrariness about the selection of that particular characteristic and in even knowing which beings would have that particular characteristic. So I think there's two sort of fundamental problems with that kind of perspective. The first one is that people like Joseph Fletcher suggested there were, at times he made a list of like 15 different characteristics that he thought were sort of human characteristics that could confer personhood on people. And perhaps people could even add other ones. There could be our capacities for creativity, our capacities for love and having relationships and such. These could be other kinds of capacities, or even our moral capacities for that matter. There could be other kinds of capacities that we might think of as being human that are not just what you have said. And then also, how do you determine when a being has that particular capacity?
Right. Well, they're certainly good points. And I think on the first point, whether the things that I've singled out or the broader range that Joseph Fletcher mentioned, as you say, or somebody else's view, I think that's a discussion we should be having. I think, you know, this discussion needs to be an open one. We need to think about these things. And perhaps we'll eventually reach some kind of consensus on what's important. Perhaps we'll have a range of differing views. Obviously, that can happen on ethical questions. We don't always end up agreeing. On the question of how do we determine, look, I think it's often difficult to determine, but for the purposes of making decisions, of the purposes of law, certainly, I think we should draw the line very conservatively. I mean, it's also very hard to determine when somebody has the capacity to be able to vote, for instance, or the capacity to be able to drive a car or to handle alcohol. But obviously, we do have laws that say that there are certain ages at which you can do those things. So we don't try and decide in each case. I mean, we could, I guess, try and give somebody tests before we allow them to vote, but it would be very cumbersome. We just set a line and we say, well, we think this is a reasonable place to draw the line. So I'm suggesting for these life and death decisions, we should clearly draw this line very conservatively and make sure that we're not allowing people to be killed when they do have, or when they possibly may have, some of the capacities that we might think to be relevant.
Do you want to come back on that, Richard?
So why would you draw the line then at a month for an infant being alive without, you know, at one point you're saying you're wanting it to be conservative.
Sorry, can I just get this clear? Sure. Of course I don't hold the absurd view that an infant is not alive before a month. In fact, I'm quite happy to say that a human life begins at conception. I'm quite happy to agree with pro-life people.
I didn't say anything about human life beginning there. I was mentioning the point at which you thought their life should be protected.
Right. But the view that I draw the line at a month is a view that I put forward in a book published in 1984. And I can't remember exactly when, but certainly within the next 10 years, I said that I thought it was really not possible to just have an absolute cutoff line, but that the decisions ought to be weighed up by, for example, hospital ethics committees on the individual circumstances of the case. So in thinking about a month, I was thinking of that as a conservative line. That is, I think it's pretty clear that no infant less than a month old, no infant less than a month old could have the capacities to see themselves as a self-aware being existing over time. And if you disagreed with that, then I think you would have to say, well, a lot of non-human animals would have those capacities as well, because a lot of non-human animals are going to be more self-aware, give more signs of that than a human infant of a month or something like a month old.
I mean, Richard, what are you wanting to draw out from Peter in this? Is it your view that, I mean, a lot of people will have a natural instinctive reaction that the idea of seeing a baby under a month old or whatever as less valuable or indeed legitimate at one level to kill because of particular circumstances that seem to warrant that. Nevertheless, there's a sort of instinctive recoiling for many people at that. Is that what you're appealing to, Richard? Why do you think that actually it goes beyond this issue of their cognitive abilities and so on?
You know, I think it's interesting you raise that issue, sort of instinctive reactions to it, because when I spoke at the beginning of our conversation about the issue of the meaning of life and such, and it occurs to me that this whole notion of there even being a reason for people to be concerned about the interests of others or to practice morality in the first place is, from what I understand, in Peter Singer's views, simply being put upon us by an evolutionary process, a chance process that took place without any purpose, without any
goal. No, that's not correct.
Okay, I'd be glad to be enlightened then. Please fill me in on it.
Yeah, I don't draw any values from evolution. I'm certainly not. I think that commits a well-known fallacy that philosophers talk about, the attempt to move from is to ought. And I've been pretty careful, I think, to avoid that in my writings over my entire career. I think that the values that we get from reflection on the world and on our place in the world. I think we can see when we do that we are one being among others living in the world. We care about our own interests, obviously. We care about our own well-being and our own happiness and don't want to suffer greatly. But when we look at other beings who can also suffer, we can see that that's a bad thing for them in something like the same way that our suffering is a bad thing for us. And I think we can see that we shouldn't just take our own self-interested perspective on this, that would be something that is actually contrary to our ability to understand that we are just one being among others. To just say, yeah, well, I'm one among others, but I just don't care about the others. That seems to me to be wrong.
What were you kind of leading up to then, Richard, in terms of your view on Peter's a take on evolution or where it does or doesn't lead us in terms of human value?
My point was that he does claim very forthrightly in his Practical Ethics that there is no purpose, overall purpose in the universe. And so even though he may not claim that morality is just something put upon us by evolution, that there are other kinds of rational considerations or something that may be there, he does argue that because of the chance processes that have taken place over time, that there is no overall purpose to life and no overall meaning to the cosmos in general. So he does go on to say, and here I'm actually quoting, now that it has resulted in the existence of beings who prefer some state of affairs to others, however, it may be possible for particular lives to be meaningful. And then you go on to say, in this sense, atheists can find meaning in life. But what I don't see is how you can get from a meaningless universe with no purpose to a situation where then there are there is morality that then should cause people to then have value for other people, to be aware, not just be aware of, but to respect their preferences. Because let's face it, there's lots of people out there who delight in doing bad things. I mean, that's part of the reason why you have to write moral philosophy, is because there's people out there who don't want to do the right thing. Genghis Khan, for example, delighted in plundering and killing and raping and pillaging. He's not alone out there. There's a lot of people that do it on a much smaller level, on a day-to-day basis. They cut down other people. They delight in causing pain to other people. So what is it that would then
what provides the ought
cause us
in
or
that
motivate
sense.
Us to yeah, live right. this live this moral life or think
okay,
that that's
okay.
something we have to
good.
Do?
Good. So,
go ahead, Peter. Yeah.
Firstly, you're quite correct to say that I don't think there is any purpose in the universe as a whole. I don't think it was created for a purpose. And I think when you look at evolution and the way in which it's worked, it's pretty clear that there is no purpose in that, and certainly not a purpose of a benevolent creator, because it just seems to be such an incredibly, such an indirect and often a way of developing that so often includes so much pain and suffering. Secondly, you're quite right, again, but unfortunate, that there are many people in the world who don't care about others, and even some, a smaller number, who actually delight in inflicting suffering on others. And let me just say, some of those people, of course, are religious believers who do believe in a God and in a purpose in the universe, and some of them are atheists who don't believe in a God and a purpose in the universe. But to answer your specific question, why do I say that we can give meaning to our lives? Well, that's because we are purposive beings. We are beings who have purposes of our own, and we can find some things fulfilling and meaningful to us. So it's not meaningful sort of full stop. I don't think that any life is sort of meaningful in the sense of being meaningful somehow to the universe or to the creator of the universe, since I don't believe there is such a creator. But I do think we can find our own lives meaningful. And so, for instance, we may decide that we are going to try to reduce the amount of suffering in the world in some way or other. We may commit ourselves to trying to improve the position of some of the poorest people in the world, or we may try to reduce the suffering we inflict on animals. And we may find those meaningful and fulfilling things. And we may say things like that if we compare it to somebody who, let's say, is spending their life sitting on the sofa watching sitcoms on TV. We may say, look, that's really a pretty mean thing to do, you know. How are you making a positive difference to the world? You're not. You're just going to exist and then you'll go and it'll be no difference. Whereas if you try to make the world a better place, you will find that more fulfilling. You'll actually enjoy living that life better. And you will, you know, on your deathbed, should you have the chance to reflect on your deathbed, think, I've lived my life in a worthwhile way because there's less suffering in the world because of the things that I've done. And I think that that's important.
Richard?
But once again, you're using these moral terms, making it a better world. But if there is no purpose and meaning in the world in general, how can we make things a better world? There's no morality inscribed in the universe. In fact, I think you even said that, that morality is not in the fabric of the universe. I think that's sort of a quote from you, or at least close to a quote from you. So if there's no morality in the fabric of the universe, then how are we making the world better? I understand what you're saying, that we're helping individuals – and we're making their lives better, but what difference does that make if there's no meaning in the universe?
You're listening to Unbelievable with me, Justin Briley. My guests are at present on the program, Richard Weikart and ethicist Peter Singer, and we're going to be continuing this discussion on whether there is an innate intrinsic value to human life, and we'll allow Peter to respond in just a moment's time to that question of Richard. Unbelievable, available of course for download as well if you want to go online, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Do join us again in a moment's time.
If you've ever found yourself cornered by a skeptic who is intent on challenging your faith, and you've thought, how can I answer, or what do I say? Let the Christian Thinkers Society help. Our mission is to teach Christians to become thinkers and thinkers to become Christians. We train believers to understand the core truths of their faith and how to demonstrate why Christianity makes sense. Find us at this year's Unbelievable, the conference. And for Jeremiah J. Johnson's new book, Unanswered, visit christianthinkers.com and find the answers you need.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to Unbelievable with me, Justin Briley. This is the second part of today's programme, here as part of Faith Explored on Premier Christian Radio. Been going for 10 years now, and many, many people download the podcast every week. If you want to join them, perhaps you haven't discovered it online, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Unbelievable, always joined by top-notch guests, interesting discussions. We'll hear some more of your feedback to other shows as well towards the end of today's programme. And, of course, from Tanya Walker. Tanya is one of the speakers joining us for Unbelievable, the conference 2016 this year on Saturday the 2nd of July. I'll be speaking to her later on in the programme about what she's going to be presenting on in terms of truth and reason and how we come to have faith in Jesus, in God and so on. But if you want to get along to the conference and hear from some great speakers like Tanya and just enjoy that big feel of the community event, bring together lots of people who are enthusiastic about Unbelievable, reasoning, Christian faith, apologetics and so on, do go online and get yourself signed up for the conference. That's at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable2016. Really looking forward to seeing many show listeners there. Well, we're talking today about whether intrinsically human life has some kind of value. Richard Weikart, my Christian guest. Later on, we're going to be hearing from Susan Blackmore, who's an atheist philosopher and psychologist. But we've been having a conversation between Richard and Peter Singer, who's an Australian ethicist, of course, well known in his field. He comes from an atheistic point of view. Now, in that last section, Peter, Richard put the question to you, if there's no morality in the fabric of the universe, and how are we making the world better? Saying, I understand we're helping individuals, making their lives better, but what difference does that make if there's no meaning in the universe?
Well, I don't think you have to believe in a God to think that the universe is a better place if there is less suffering. Let's say, for example, that we had been able to prevent the Holocaust. I think the universe would have been a better place if those 6 million or so people had not been murdered and had not suffered often terribly in the process of being murdered. And I think to deny that is really a pretty strange view, to say, well, you know, if you don't believe in a creator, somehow you can't say it was a bad thing that millions of people got very cruelly treated, or, you know, your example, Genghis Khan, that he pillaged and raped and so on, that you can't say that was a bad thing unless you think there's a creator in the universe. I mean,
do you want to come back on that, Richard? What is that what you're saying?
Well, what does make that? I mean, I understand you're going to say, well, it's creating more pain and less pleasure, but what is it that makes that in and of itself a bad thing? I mean, you've emphasized this notion that pleasure is what is the good of the good, what brings moral goodness. Pain is morally negative, but what is it? I mean, those things are simply states of existence of things in the universe, and why was that? Does more pain or less pleasure make things worse in the universe, or vice versa? I mean, I don't see how you can get from there to this purpose and meaning that you try to get.
Well, I have to say I find that strange, and I think there would be, you know, many people who wouldn't agree with you about that. That, I mean, for one thing, if my own life were to go badly and I were to suffer agonizingly for years, in either because of somebody else's evil doing or because of contracting a painful disease or something like that, I would think my life is worse now. And if I then think I can say that about my own life, and I imagine that happening to some stranger, then I would think, well, that stranger's life is worse. And if I imagine it happening to millions of strangers, then I think, well, clearly that's significantly worse for the world as a whole, for, if you like, the pattern of what happens in the universe. The pattern of what happens is worse in the same way that my life would be worse if I suffered. So it's worse for everyone.
Just a quick response, Richard, and then I think we'll have to start to wind this conversation up with Peter.
I'm certainly very gratified that Peter wants to end pain and promote pleasure. I think those are good things. But ultimately, I believe there are things that are even higher than promoting pleasure and diminishing pain for people. And I would suggest that love is one of those things. Relationships that we have, and loving relationships, are more important than that, even though, of course, they can contribute to having pleasure. But that's not the highest standard in the universe for morality, I would say.
Before you go, Peter, I mean, one of the things that we've circled around, and which I think it would be great to hear your particular view on, is this thing that you've been criticised by both Right to Life groups and disability activists and so on, is your view of the newborn. And you've been accused of promoting infanticide and so on because of your view that there is, in a sense, less value to a newborn life, and especially, you know, that there might be mitigating circumstances where there may be some kind of a disability, which does provide moral grounds for terminating, not just in the womb, but even outside the womb, a baby. So what is your take on that? Are you of the view that it is okay with certain types of disability to kill newborn babies if they're suffering in that way?
Well, let me tell you how I came to formulate these views. I was directing a bioethics centre in Australia, and we had some doctors from one of the major hospitals that deals with newborn infants with problems come to talk to us, and they wanted our views about how to handle some of these cases, and they described some conditions where they said, you know, they thought the prospects were very bad for any kind of quality of life for the child to have. And there was, you know, quite likely in some cases there wouldn't really be suffering because there wasn't even really consciousness, cases like anencephaly, and other less severe cases where there would be some consciousness and some suffering. So we said, well, how do you handle these cases? And they said, well, we discussed them with the parents, we described the prognosis, and if the parents agree, then we don't give life-supporting treatment. And so we said, well, what happens when you don't give life-supporting treatment? And they said, well, normally the infant will die. And we said, how long does that take? And they said, well, it may take some weeks. In some cases, it may take some months. And I have to say, I was rather shocked by this, because if you've made a decision that it's better that this infant should die, and that's what doctors were, and I should say still are doing in hospitals, neonatal intensive care units everywhere in the world, then if you've made that decision, wouldn't it be better if that child could die quickly and without further suffering and distress? And also in terms of the suffering and distress of the parents, who very often would come in and visit their infant while the infant basically withered away, maybe was killed by some pneumonia, or maybe really just wasn't being fed or something of that sort.
Starvation or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, that's why we, my colleague Helga Kuzer and I wrote Should the Baby Live, in which we argued that once you've made this decision, and I agree it's a difficult decision to make, and it should only be made with when that's what the parents think is best for their baby and their family. But once you've made it, I do think that it ought to be permissible to take active steps to end the baby's life, rather than to, as the doctors would said, allow nature to take its course.
Is there a line to be drawn? I mean, what would you say a parent should have the right to terminate a baby with let's say a less severe form of disability, Down syndrome, for instance? Would that be grounds for a baby just born? The parent had no idea that the baby had Down syndrome in the womb. They see that it has. They can anticipate that's going to mean a huge life decisions and changes and an element of difficulty and suffering in their own life. Should that parent have the option to terminate that life because a baby has Down syndrome?
I think probably normally not in that case, because the baby is not going to be suffering. I mean, if you look at people with Down syndrome, they can have lives of good quality. You know, in some cases, it may be that the parents don't want to bring up the child with Down syndrome. I would hope then that they could find another loving and caring home, parents who will adopt that child and will give the child a good life.
So there is, there's a sliding scale for what kind of would amount to a case for the termination of a life.
Yeah, there is. And of course, there are difficult decisions on that grey area. I am going to have to go at this point.
Thank you very much for being with us, Peter. Really appreciate your contribution towards today's programme, and look forward to perhaps having you on for future discussions. All the very best. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Richard, Peter obviously not able to stay on the line for any longer, and so we'll have to kind of do this in his absence now, and we're looking forward to being joined by Sue Blackmore as well in just a moment's time. But what's your initial response to what Peter had to say there about the his view on disability, especially of newborns, and whether there are situations where it's better to end their life than allow it to drag out and kind of die by not providing the kind of life-sustaining type of treatment that hospitals would normally provide if they were trying to sustain a life.
Well, I can understand that it fits perfectly logically into the system that he's created, where pain is worse than death, ultimately. So for him, if something is in miserable pain, it's better off dead. So the solution to something having a painful existence is to kill it. But to me, this seems to not make a lot of sense ethically. And I think most people, like you said earlier, their instincts would be revolted by that, because I think we realize that pain is not worse than death. That the death of a being is the end of its existence. A painful being is still existing, and I think that can still have value in their life, even if they're going through pain.
At what level does your Judeo-Christian view of all humans being made in the image of God impact that? Because I assume that whereas you would see Peter's sort of view on his atheism, that there is no overall purpose to the universe and so on, and that means that we, and you believe that makes it hard for him to justify individual human purpose. Presumably your view of purpose being very different also impacts your view on those kinds of ethical issues about whether different types of humans at different stages in development have the same kind of value.
Well, certainly. I believe that humans are created in the image of God. And because of that, and that's one of the reasons I raised the issue of capacities earlier, that I think there are other kinds of things that of what it means to be made in the image of God. One of it is that we have capacities for love. It's not just about rational capacities. We have capacities for love and having loving relationships. God is love. And so when he created us as an image, he created us to be loving creatures, loving beings. And so that's a capacity that we have that gives us value, but it's not just a bundle of capacities either. Humans being created in God's image have value in and of themselves, whether or not they have certain capacities at certain times of their lives. God loves us, and we can love him.
Well, you're listening to Unbelievable today, discussing whether humans have some kind of intrinsic moral value. Don't forget, you can find today's show at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Richard Vicart continues to join me as we continue today's show. And up next, he'll be interacting with atheist psychologist and philosopher Susan Blackmore.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, look, let's bring in Susan Blackmore at this point. Susan, thank you very much for patiently being on the line. And you've been listening to the conversation that happened there between Peter and Richard during the course of this programme. What do you want to step in with? What have been your overall thoughts in regards to this discussion?
Well, it's really fascinating and raising issues I'm looking forward to talking about. Partly depressing to hear Richard talking in this way about us being made in the image of God. We're flesh and blood creatures on a planet. To say that God is love and we must love him and so on, but if we're in his image, what about all these people who don't love, who've not had the opportunity to be brought up in a loving way so that they're capable of love themselves? The view that there's a creator there seems to me to stand in the way of clear-sighted morality, of thinking about what matters and what doesn't matter, putting the intrinsic value of life above pain, suffering, compassion, love. It seems to me upside down, and I think has led to us making very bad decisions in the past. Thank goodness we're moving away from Christian societies to secular society. Well, that's not the opposite. From Christian societies to non-believing, non-religious societies. I'm very glad. I mean, in Britain now, more people are non-believers than believers, and I think this is contributing to us getting away from the straitjacket of beliefs that depend on the intrinsic value of life.
Okay. Just a reminder today that we're talking about whether human life is intrinsically valuable. If you want to get in touch yourself, you're welcome to email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Don't forget you can find this show online, listen back to it and send us your thoughts that way as well via the show. PremierChristianRadio.com/unbelievable. And we're talking to Richard Vicart and in this section of the programme to Susan Blackmore as well, who's an atheist philosopher and psychologist. Richard's new book, The Death of Humanity, and the Case for Life. He claims that ideas once used to justify genocide, famine, compulsory sterilization are back in vogue today because the idea that human life is intrinsically valuable is dying side by side with our Christian culture. Well, in a way, that we should be dispensing with the idea that human life is intrinsically valuable when we've got other considerations to make, say people like Peter Singer, who we had on already, and also Sue, who's on the line now. We heard there, didn't we, Richard, that as far as Sue's concerned, Christian morality, this view of the sanctity of human life above and beyond, you know, other considerations of pain and everything else, is actually has been a bad thing for us morally. What's your take on that?
Well, I can understand some of what Sue is saying about Christianity, because it hasn't lived up to its morality in many cases. But in terms of the sanctity of human life, the point is to protect those who are weak and to have love for those who are poor, distressed, the widow, the orphan, and in this case, too, those that are the weakest members of our society, and to provide protection for them from those that want to destroy life and bring death to them. And so while Christianity has not lived up to, especially in the broadest sense of that term, has not lived up to its own morality by indulging in the Inquisition, Crusades, dominating Europe, persecuting unbelievers, all sorts of things like that, where they have not lived up to the sanctity of human life. Nonetheless, the point of the sanctity of human life is to protect those that are weak and to protect people from those that do want to snuff out their lives.
Sue?
I'm thinking all the time about some specific cases here. One thing that is obsessing a lot of people at the moment is the end of life. I feel here I am, arrived on this planet. My awareness, my self-knowledge, my capacity to think and so on emerged gradually as I developed from a fetus to an infant to a grown-up. I'm lucky enough to be born in a country and with a family that's brought me up in a moral way and to have lived a rich and fulfilling life. But I'm looking forward in a world where medicine can keep us alive and keep us alive and keep us alive to think about my own death. I found my parents' deaths, one of them terribly distressing, one partly distressing, because they were both kept alive with dementia long, long, long after, in my opinion, they should have been. And my mother saying every day, many, many times, I just want to die, I just want to go, oh, please, I want to go. I don't want to be like that. I would love our society to move beyond the position now, and partly these Christian values are to blame here. I would love the thought that we would have that sanctity is not life itself, but as Peter Singer was saying, it to do with pain and suffering, to do with hope and love and compassion. I would love, if I'm getting to the end of my life and I don't want to live anymore and I still have the clear capacity to say that and my family have the capacity to agree that that's what I want, to choose the time of my own death, to have people around me that I want and to say, this is the day when I'm going to die. I can say goodbye. I can say the kind of things that people always want to say on deathbeds, the kind of things that, and allow my loved ones to say the kind of things that people often regret when someone's dying and they didn't get the chance to say it, and be able to choose. It's my life. It's not God's life. It's not Jesus's life. It's mine and my family's and all the people I'm involved with. That seems to me so much more important, and is not helped by Christian
values. And for you, having the ability to decide the way in which you die, rather than, as it were, that you not having the capacities to control that anymore at a certain point in it would be important, obviously. I mean, this is a common argument for euthanasia, assisted dying, and so on, Richard. What's your response to that in the book? I'm sure it's something that you do take on.
Oh, yes, I definitely take on the issues of euthanasia. But I think basically, once you have the perspective that human life doesn't have any value or purpose or meaning, which is the position that I understand Sue and many other secularists to be taking, then I can understand why you wouldn't want to prolong life at some particular point, because you don't see any purpose or value or meaning in your life at all in any kind of real sense and any kind of objective sense, let's put it that way. Again, like Peter Singer says, you might say there's some particular meaning that you give to your own life. So I can understand why people that taking that particular perspective would say that their life doesn't have any meaning or value. But my whole my understanding is that the life does have purpose and meaning and value. And so we should not think that we have the right to take our own lives, just like we wouldn't have the right to take anyone else's life, because it doesn't belong to us in the first place. And so contrary to what Sue said, it doesn't belong to us. It does belong to God as our creator, since he created us.
I mean, this then is just a fundamental clash of your both your worldviews, isn't it, Sue? Because
obviously... No, hang on. I want to jump on that.
Go on then, go on.
He's accusing me of saying that human life has no value. I never said that, and I wouldn't say that. I would say that life itself, human life itself, does not have intrinsic value just by virtue of being life. The fact that a body is alive is not the important thing. I'm completely with Peter Singer on this, although not in everything that he says. Of course, imagining again coming to the end of my life, yes, life has some value. Yes, being alive and not dead has some value, but that value comes from all the things that have happened in my life, all the people I've been involved with, the effect, good and bad, that they've had, and so on. And when that life of mine we're talking about in this case comes to the point where I'm suffering, I'm causing suffering to others through my own suffering, I don't want to be there anymore, that's what I'm talking about. I'm not wiping out all value of life at all.
How important is it, for instance, you have thrived as an intellectual, Susan, and in a sense I can see that brings huge fulfillment to your life, to be able to engage in these kinds of discussions, to teach others and so on. If it weren't a case that you were in pain, but your intellectual capacities went, would that be for you cause enough for you to want to seek to end your life? Because from that point of view, a large aspect of what makes your life worth living would have ended.
That's an absolutely wonderful question. Not one I've thought about for a long time, but I can tell you why I think it's such a wonderful question. Mm. Because I can remember as a teenager, and indeed I think at university, thinking that if I lost my ability, my intellectual ability, I wouldn't be me anymore and I wouldn't want to be alive. I can remember at school, in a way, I was terrible, terrible school. I mean, it was a very posh, expensive boarding school, but it was a nightmare. I was desperately unhappy, and really I sort of fought for who I was just through by being clever and, you know, being top in exams and things like that, a very narrow, restricted, unhappy way of being a teenager. And I grew out of that, and I can remember thinking about, hang on a minute, if I weren't clever anymore, well, I'd just be a different person. That's fine, I'm going to change anyway. We all change through our lives. And I've come through my lifetime to think of that, you know, braininess, if you like, to be just happens to be what, you know, this body was born with. Mm. It's not intrinsically so value, you know, I've become more to value love and compassion and sharing things with people and caring about suffering during my lifetime. I have also found happiness in many other things. So the simple answer to your question is, I would become a gardener or a painter. Those are two things I do. I have chickens. I grow all our vegetables. I help with the cutting down of trees and making. We try to, you know, use a cycle of wood and growing our own trees to heat the house. And, you know, there are many, many things that I would carry on. I don't know quite what I'd say about it. Oh God, I woke up this morning and I can't write another book because I can't think straight. But you know, yes, I think this creature here would find fulfillment in weeding and tending the vegetables.
In things that weren't in that sense intellectually you know, straining.
Absolutely.
but you would still see there would still be other purposes that you have accumulated in that sense, things that you value about your life.
Absolutely.
Richard, what do you make then of Sue's view that you can't sort of say to her She doesn't have value. She absolutely does have these values, these things that give her life fulfillment and so on. And she doesn't see any need to kind of appeal to a higher purpose or value for life in order to say that there are things that make life valuable for her. And if someone gets to the point where they don't feel that the level of pain or suffering or whatever it might be that they're experiencing themselves or those around them are experiencing, they should have the right to choose when to end their life in that sense.
Well, I'm sorry that I put words in her mouth, and I'm sorry by using that term not having value, that because she apparently objected to that part of it. But I still, just as with Peter Singer, I still have difficulty seeing how you get from a universe without purpose and meaning. And in my book, actually, Sue, I actually quote you at one point. In fact, I have about a page discussion of you in my book. And one of the quotes I have in here from an interview that you did says, "It seems to me that as far as I can tell, the universe has no ultimate purpose. It's pointless." So I still can't understand how you can get from a pointless universe that has no meaning, no purpose in the overarching sense, to the sense that then your own human life has some kind of value. And I think you even said it doesn't have, either you or Peter, one of you said it didn't have intrinsic value, but that's really what we're talking about when we're talking about value, I think.
Well, let's take a quick break and we'll let Susan come back on this. We're talking about whether human life is intrinsically valuable. It's one of those philosophical, ethical, moral discussions. It's turned into sort of areas of euthanasia, abortion, infanticide and so on. And so we'll finish off this conversation with my guests who still with me, Richard Weikart, author of The Death of Humanity and The Case for Life, and Susan Blackmore, who's well-known here in the UK as an atheist philosopher and psychologist, and will be hearing what they have to say towards the end of today's edition of Unbelievable.
Premier Christianity, for cutting-edge commentary and encouraging stories. Tackling the big issues to help you live out your faith.
In the latest edition, we ask, is your smartphone killing your relationship with God? How to wait on the Lord in an age of instant communication and constant distraction. Plus, we hear stories of God on the move, literally, as we open up how a bus, tube or train ride could be your next opportunity to tell someone about Jesus. All that, plus the usual news, reviews and inspiring Christian testimonies.
For your free copy of Premier Christianity, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample.
Welcome back to the final part of today's Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. Now, if you're a regular listener to the show, you'll know that I present Unbelievable every week. You may not be as familiar with my other role here at Premier, which is the editor of Premier Christianity magazine, a monthly publication packed with interesting stuff every month. And if you're interested in the sorts of things Unbelievable covers, you might be interested in the story we're featuring in our May edition of David Wood, From Nihilism to New Life in Christ. Talks about how he was transformed after being put in prison, having tried to murder his father and encountering a Christian there. If you're interested in reading that, you can get a free sample copy of the magazine, premierchristianity.com/freesample. We've also got his story up on the front page of our website at the moment. If you're interested in what's coming up at the same time next week, then we're going to be hearing from an old show favourite. David Robertson joins me on the programme there. He's going to be in studio talking to a show listener, Mike Rand, about his search for truth. He's an agnostic, is Mike, but says he had a sort of spiritual experience several years ago and has been looking ever since into whether Christianity could be true. Hear their discussion on the programme next week on why Mike just can't quite believe. We're going to be hearing some of your feedback as well later on in today's show, as well as from Tanya Walker, one of our speakers at this year's Unbelievable Conference 2016. Again, if you want to book tickets, do go to the website to check that out for Saturday, the 2nd of July, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable2016.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, we're concluding our discussion on whether human life is intrinsically valuable. That's a value, actually, that society is losing as it dispenses with Christian culture, says Richard Weikart in his new book, The Death of Humanity and The Case for Life. says we're going back to an age where we're justifying genocide, forced famine, compulsory sterilization. Those were things we've seen in other cultures that we rejected, but do modern ethics actually, are they pointing us back in that direction? Earlier on in the show we had Peter Singer, bioethicist at Princeton University, well known for his writing in this area, and someone who Richard takes to task in this new book, and interestingly Susan herself, who now joins us on the line. Susan Blackmore, an atheist philosopher and psychologist herself, is also comes in for criticism in the book as well. Susan, what Richard was saying in that last section was simply that if you do believe there's no ultimate purpose to the universe and there's no intrinsic value in that sense to human life, how can you make the leap in that sense to individual purposes and individual value in the way that you apparently do?
Well, this is another way in which Darwin's brilliant insight provides the answer, because what we can see in this pointless universe is the way amazing designs, living things, incredibly complex systems arise by the process of natural selection, by the fact that on a rich and thriving planet, not everything can survive, and because most things die and the ones that live pass on their characteristics to the next generation, design appears as it were by magic, but it isn't magic, it's by natural selection, it's actually, if you like, it's killing by death. I mean, this is the sad fact of how evolution works. It's only because of all the things that fail that the ones that succeed get better and better design, and we get wings and eyes and amazing things, and here we are. And in the midst of all that, we also get creatures capable of suffering, of love, of community. In many species, as well as humans, we find parents loving their children and loving their partners and forming communities and working together and having to have the beginnings of moral value. And then you come to humans, who are so much more complex again, with the kind of intelligence and culture and so on that we have. And out of that emerge meanings. Out of that emerges the capacity for humans to see suffering in others. And rats can do this too, and so can some birds. You know, a rat seeing another rat locked up in a cage with no food will pick up food and carry it and give it to the one that doesn't have any. So, you know, these things are coming about through the animal kingdom. And here we are as an animal capable of intense and deep suffering because of how clever we are, because of our capabilities and the capacity to see others suffering. And out of that, I think, comes the longing to have a world which is more full of love and less full of pain and anguish.
I suppose my question, Sue, is that all still ultimately, though, rooted in genetics, in our evolutionary drive? Even altruism, yes, is actually an outworking of a simple, yes, kind of a simple law, effectively.
Yes, yes.
Okay,
so there's no ultimate purpose.
Let's allow Richard to respond then. Yes, go ahead, Richard.
So, Sue, then am I taking you to agree with E.O. Wilson and Michael Ruse when they made their kind of famous statement that morality is an illusion fobbed off on us by our genes to get us to cooperate? Does that describe your position?
No, not really. I mean, it's partly the way that's put, fobbed off on us. No, I mean, I don't think it's a trick. No, I think it's the glue that makes human society possible. We wouldn't be able to have the kind of societies we have, or our capacity to go from, you've talked about the Holocaust, Genghis Khan, all of these things. It is amazing. Steven Pinker points out this a lot. It is amazing the way the number of killings, homicide, and all sorts of cruelty and so on have decreased over thousands and thousands of years. We have managed to create societies. Yes, we often fail, but we have managed to create societies that have things like a national health service, that have laws that protect the weak, that have general encouraging people, bringing children up in school to care about people of other races and other kinds. The fact that we've now gay marriage, we have equality for people with different sexual orientations. These kinds of things are real, real progress. That is all possible on the basis of an animal that
I have a feeling that
natural selection.
That Rich is going to ask you the same question you asked to Peter, which is, in a pointless universe, how can you speak of progress? Progress towards what? Is there an ultimate sort of out there goal of morality that you do believe we're progressing towards? Or what do you mean by progress in a ultimately pointless universe?
No, I don't think there's any goal we're going towards. I think it's the same if you look at the whole evolutionary process and see the wonders of what's appeared without any direction, without any final plan. It's all happened in the way
What do you mean by progress, then? What are we progressing toward? You always think of progress as towards a goal, don't you?
Did I use the word progress? I mean, I if I did, then I'll have to qualify it and say, I look at the world, and because of my intrinsic preference for happiness and joy and love over suffering, cruelty and pain, I would see progress as being a world in which we increase the love and compassion and sharing and so on, and we decrease the pain and suffering and cruelty. It's not ultimate progress towards any goal. It is progress in the sense of that's all. I mean, it's hard. It's so easy to put a God in place and say, this is God's will, this is where we're going. But when you actually look into what the kingdom of heaven would be like, you know, it doesn't make a lot of sense. So I would rather take the view of being accepting that I live in a pointless universe, the amazing wonders of what has appeared, do my best with a tiny little one life amongst billions, to do that, what seems to me better.
Yeah.
Kindness over cruelty.
Let's bring Richard back in. So she feels saying that morality is an illusion fobbed off on us by evolution is not quite right, because it's about this, you know, for want of a better word, progress towards a state where there is just more general happiness and so on. Richard, what's your problem with that then?
Well, I find that actually rather ironic in light of the fact that she talked about the mass death that the Darwinian struggle for existence necessarily entails. She actually used the word sad fact, which I thought was interesting, because that implies a moral judgment of the process of evolution itself, which means you're taking a moral position relating to something in a pointless universe. So I find that kind of ironic, but I also have some empirical problems with the notion that violence is decreasing and such. I know Steven Pinker's put out a book where he makes those kind of claims, but I really don't. In the long view of things, I mean, I have severe problems thinking about reading the newspapers, listening to the news, seeing what's going on in the world today, and thinking about the fact that we're a society with much less violence. Of course, also from my perspective, and Sue and I are going to disagree on this issue, of course, but also my perspective of killing of unborn infants being an act of violence, we're actually killing far more people today, human beings today, than have been killed in most ages in the past. But even aside from that, I'm not convinced that violence has been decreased that significantly.
So we're going to have to start wrapping things up. Obviously, from Richard's point of view, and his whole book is about this, he thinks that by dispensing with this idea of intrinsic human value, we are kind of sleepwalking towards those things that we abhor, or we said we've abhorred in the past, eugenics, compulsory sterilization, and those sorts of things. Why do you think that that dispensing with the intrinsic that nature of the value of human life doesn't necessarily mean we'll be walking towards that kind of a future?
I think we're walking away from a straitjacket of an ancient religion whose morality was designed in a world without modern medicine, without the kind of society and the capacities and the technology we have now. We're going towards a society where we can open our eyes and our hearts and think much, much more deeply about what really matters. I mean, abortion is another big issue, of course. If you believe in the intrinsic value of life just for the sake of life, you are causing unbelievable suffering to parents, particularly mothers, all over the world. The fetus is not capable of suffering like a mother is. Bringing children in, forcing mothers to bring up kids that they didn't want and couldn't cope with, and therefore will produce children with difficult, you know, they will pass on these difficulties to their children if they have them. We are just moving in a much better direction away from the cruelty that arises from taking the intrinsic value of life, but, you know, by virtue of believing in a creator. I'm optimistic, but I get a bit depressed when I think about the hanging on of these ideas that are so oppressive and so cruel.
Thank you very much for joining us in the latter part of today's conversation, Sue. Really appreciate that. If people want to find out more about you, where should they go to find out more?
Oh, well, I have a big website, which I maintain myself, which is full of all kinds of stuff and has a section on religion and atheism and so on. I'm on Facebook, but that's looked after by my assistant. I do try to also put things on there and answer questions on there, so you can try either of those.
Great. Thank you very much for being with me today. Richard, we'll finish with you then. Obviously, you've disagreed strongly with both Peter and Sue in the course of today's programme. From Sue's point of view, as we heard there, as far as she's concerned, dispensing with this intrinsic view of human life as inherently valuable will actually free us to be more compassionate, to weigh things more properly in terms of our current view of what we know about life, biology, evolution, medicine, and so on. And so for her, it's actually a progressive thing, not a regressive thing, to not sort of hang on to that particular kind of what she would see as a religiously driven kind of value.
Well, Holland and Belgium are two of the most advanced. Switzerland are three of the most advanced countries in Europe along the way toward allowing physician-assisted suicide and suicide of all sort. And I think it's a hard argument to make that what they are doing is actually compassionate for people in many, many, many cases. People are committing suicide without even having any pain. People are flying to Switzerland to commit or to engage in what's sometimes called suicide tourism. A lady in Italy who was losing her beauty decided that was grounds enough to go commit suicide in Switzerland and goes and does it. In Belgium, a psychiatrist signed off for assisted suicide for a man who was transgender, had a gender change, sex change operation. She'd been grown up as a girl. She'd been despised for being a girl by her own parents. Got a sex change operation, hated it, and then she gets a psychiatrist to sign off for her suicide. I mean, this is not a compassionate society, and despite the fact that people think it's compassion, what's compassion would be to support the people in their weaknesses. In fact, if you look at the Oregon in the United States, which does have much tighter regulations in how assisted suicide can operate, in Oregon, there are a large number of people that commit assisted suicide who have very little in the way of networks of family and friends. And so they don't have the kind of loving support that people have very often going through these kinds of terminal illnesses. And so they decide to commit suicide. So I don't see it as compassion. I see it as a lack of compassion, a lack of
in
love,
that sense, it's
a lack of the kind of loving networks that we need to have.
A kind of an indictment of society that we have got to the point where people are so individualistic in that sense in their view of life that they, because they don't have these networks, you would say that's driving them towards this idea that, well, I might as well end my life. I mean, I imagine Sue would say it's important kind of from both ends to make sure people are fulfilled. But it's an interesting point.
But just
go ahead.
But just by putting the law forward and allowing people to do it and participating in it by having physicians actually administer the prescriptions to the drugs and such, we are putting our stamp of approval on it and saying basically your life is valueless. Your life doesn't matter anymore. And so we're going to support you if you want to end your life. It's not just a matter of letting you do it and not prosecuting you for it. We're going to say we're going to help you.
Well, look, it's been great having you on, and thanks to Sue as well. And as ever, we were never going to get to a point of agreement between my guests. So that's the point of the show, really, in many ways. We aim to open up these issues, and I'm sure you'll want to comment as well. I'll make sure to give you the ways to get in touch in a moment's time, and I'm sure the comments will be flying around underneath today's programme online as well. You can find that at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Really interesting show today. Is human life intrinsically valuable? Thanks to both Richard Vicart. Richard, thanks for being with me. Thank you, Sue, as well, for being on the line.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks also to Peter Singer, who was with us earlier as well. You've been listening to me, Justin Brierley, on today's programme, and we'll be hearing some of your feedback in a moment's time.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, if you do want to get in touch, as ever, it's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. to email me your thoughts about today's show. Look forward to reading those. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook as well, @UnbelievableJB or facebook.com/unbelievable. @unbelievablejb to let me know your thoughts that way. Not too much time for your feedback this week, I'm afraid, and we'll try and make more space next time, because I want to make space for speaking to Tanya Walker from Arzim UK in a moment's time. But thanks for those who got in touch about the documentary I aired on the podcast last week. Before we hear some of that, just a quick mention that the Unbelievable Christian and Skeptic Discussion Group has its monthly meeting this coming Monday, so depending on when you're hearing this, maybe too late, but Monday, May the 9th, again, as usual, the usual destination, the William the Fourth pub. Let's be honest, shall we? Fess up is the theme of this month's discussion, and it's going to be challenging all the people there, Christians or non-Christians, to admit the problems they might have within their own worldview. Think of that programme we did on Unbelievable back in January, I think it was, in which an atheist and a Christian swapped roles and tried to kind of give the best case for the other's position. It's going to be something along those lines. So if you want to find out more about that, go to the meetup.com website and look for the Unbelievable Christian and Skeptic Discussion Group meeting in London. Thanks for those who have been tweeting their thanks for last week's podcast. We just did a podcast last week because of on-air we were doing our fundraising appeal. Matt Frey says, grass cutting season in Pennsylvania means catching up on the Unbelievable podcast. Ehrman and Borkum debates 1 and 2 are excellent. Daniel Kendrick said of the show I did looking at the American megachurches and our experience touring a couple of them. So excited to listen. Ben Doggett said, loved this one, Justin. Fascinating and brilliantly made. Any suggestions for where I can find more like it? Well, there is a section of the Unbelievable website, Ben, where I put a few more kind of detailed features, documentary-style pieces. If you go there, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable, you can find it just a little way down the page there. Mark Garnett says, I was so impressed with this week's Unbelievable podcast. Made me think about how we do church in the US. Good work, Justin. And Matt Frad said, your kids have the most adorable accents. Thank you very much, Matt. Jazz, who goes under the handle @biblicalscholar, says, a brief reflection on how you might now, 7 years on, evaluate the two differently would be good. No time for that today, Jazz, but maybe another time. And thanks also to a couple of people who got in touch hearing that I was going to be out in the States again this summer, saying we'd love to see you. I've had invitations from Salt Lake City, from Alaska, from Oregon, church planters in those places who'd be interested in meeting up. Who knows what may be possible, but we'll see. Thank you very much anyway for getting in touch about last week's programme. It's a great joy to be joined now by Tanya Walker from Arzim and the Oxford Centre for Christian Apologetics. She's one of the speakers at this year's Unbelievable Conference, and we're going to be talking a little bit about her faith journey and what she's going to be talking about at this year's conference as well. Tanya, welcome along to the programme.
Thanks for having me, Justin.
It's great to talk to you, Tanya. Now, you were going to join us for our last conference in 2014, but you fell ill at the very last minute. You lost your voice, didn't you? So we were really sad not to have you. We had someone stand in, of course, but we're hoping your voice is going to be fine.
Yes, it was a fairly insurmountable obstacle not to be able to speak at all.
Anyway, these things happen. But in any case, we're delighted to have you back. Do you want to tell us a little bit about your own faith journey, Tanya, and what it means to you to be a Christian, how you've kind of gone through the intellectual issues as well as part of that?
Sure. Well, I'm one of those people who had the privilege of being brought up in a context where my parents really knew God personally. They really walked the talk. And so I kind of was exposed to Christianity at a young age. But if I'm honest, I'm a really head-oriented person, and it just wouldn't have been enough for me growing up to know, oh, my parents believe this. And so I'd say from around the age of about 12, I began to really look into it for myself. I had my own questions, kind of the big questions of life. And I wanted to know, like, this experience that I'm having with God, this sense of love and peace and joy, and also I was just able to see some really wonderfully supernatural things happen, healings, for example. I wanted to know, like, is it possible that this is all some kind of emotional, psychological manipulation, or is it true? And through a process of asking lots of questions, in the end deciding to study politics, philosophy, and economics at university, and asking more questions there, I came to the firm conviction this is true and real, as well as experientially unbelievably satisfying. But if you ask me what's the biggest difference that being a Christian has made to my life, I'd say that it has brought hope into every context of fear and anxiety, and that has been for me the biggest difference beyond the kind of the intellectual engagement with it.
I think very often in apologetics, we do tend to only focus on the
the evidential intellectual side of things. And we tend to sort of see experiential stuff as kind of a little bit downgraded because it's not objective, because it's obviously individually experienced, it's subjective. I mean, is that a mistake to kind of completely eliminate that in terms of the way we bring across Christian faith to others when we're talking about it?
For me, this would be one of those situations where it would have to be both and. If you are a Christian because you've had a wonderful experience of God, that's great. I believe that there is truth to those experiences. There's a living God who loves to encounter us, and we don't all need to be kind of super brains in order to engage with him in any way. But there are answers out there, and there is a framework of truth that exists, and it has been my joy to engage with that framework and to really bring my brain to life with God as well. So for me, I would love there to be both.
I think for both Christians and non-Christians and skeptics and atheists and so on, there can be a level at which, as long as it remains an intellectual issue to kind of be picked apart, it's safe because it's over there, and but to some extent I wonder if that sometimes functions as an excuse to never get beyond the intellectual issues, because it's a bit more dangerous when you start thinking, well, if there is this God behind these arguments and debates, then that means something quite significant for me, actually.
Yeah, I think that's really the case. I guess it's a poor analogy, but in real life human relationships, you might admire somebody from far away, or you might do your research endlessly about them. You might like to read books about them and biographies and whatever else. But actually meeting that person requires a face-to-face confrontation that's somehow more intrusive and personal. I guess with God, we're in such safe hands that I found it to be worth the risk. But I get that it can be a more immediate thing.
Yeah. We're going to be exploring in one of your seminars at the conference, Tanya, issues around truth, evidence, what it means to be able to know something is true. Now many people would say, well, look, we know what can be true. We do tests, we get evidence, we come to the best conclusion. Is that the way it functions when it comes to belief in God and faith and trust in Jesus Christ?
I do think that's partly how it functions. Yes, we look at the evidence. My concern is that often we've reduced the evidence to science and maths, and that's simply not how we live the rest of our lives. And it's not even, even so, for example, if you say, look, the only evidence that counts is the kind of evidence that you could do in a test tube. Well, that sentence itself hasn't been discovered in a test tube somewhere. It seems self-evidently true that evidence is a very broad category of things. Like in a law court, you would look at all sorts of different angles to come to a considered position about what was true. So absolutely, you look at evidence when you look at the Christian faith, but it's a broader thing than might be.
I guess I come, you know, having done Unbelievable for many years and moderated countless debates between atheists who seem like they're never going to change their mind and Christians who are firmly convinced of what they believe as well. I come to the view that a lot of people are happy to debate it, but it's almost like, well, what level of evidence could you provide in the end that would actually bring you to a point of actually changing your mind?
Yeah, you know what? I've often thought about how striking it is in the gospel when the people of the time ask Jesus for a sign. Now, some of you may be familiar with these verses, some of you may not. But in the gospels in Jesus' time, people looked at him and said, look, you are claiming to be God. We want a sign to show that to be true. And most of us think that Jesus said, look, I will not give you a sign. Actually, he said, I will not give you a sign. No sign will be given this generation apart from the sign of Jonah. And what he was referring to was the death and the resurrection of himself. What I find so unbelievable about that is that he effectively provided the most incredible sign, the most incredible evidence. He died before their very own eyes, and hundreds witnessed the resurrected Jesus in flesh in front of them. And yet we know that many, many, many people in Jesus's time did not believe. So it leads me to realize we think some cataclysmic supernatural thing might finally convince us. We're looking for evidence. We're looking for a sign. And the reality is, the evidence that exists in the world today is what we've got to engage with. And that evidence is vast. But some of us, for whatever reasons, there are other reasons of the heart, are unable to engage with the evidence. It's not that God refuses to give us evidence. It's not that he refuses to give us signs. He's given us many, but somehow sometimes we refuse to engage with them.
It's interesting stuff. We're going to open it up a lot more in the seminar. Perhaps you'd be interested in hearing more of what Tanya has to say. Can I encourage you to book in for Unbelievable, the conference? Tanya's going to be there along with many other speakers, and delighted that you, voice allowing, will be there this time, Tanya. Really looking forward to that. If you want to get your tickets and see the group options and all that kind of thing, just go to premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable2016. And I look forward to seeing you on Saturday, the 2nd of July, Tanya.
Look forward to being there. Thanks, Justin.
God bless. Well, thanks for being with me on the programme today. Hope you can come back at the same time next week. Let me tell you what's coming then.
You're unbelievable.
David Robertson is here. He's the moderator of the Free Church of Scotland. He's an apologist, an author, a church leader. He's going to be interacting with a show listener who's an agnostic, Mike Rand, as we ask, why can't Mike quite believe? Do join me again for the programme that aims to get you thinking. Same time, same place next week.